Welcome to Radio Reader. This is Reader Garth, bringing you news and stories from the News Gazette, April 19th, 2018 edition. Our first story is with regard to the University of Illinois, and it is headlined as "Speakers Denounce Hate, Don't Silence It," by Julie Worth. When Erwin Sheriminski was a law professor at the University of Southern California years ago, someone wrote a homophobic slur on a blackboard. Rather than try to find the offender, the dean put a letter in every student and faculty mailbox explaining why the incident was inconsistent with the kind of community the law school wanted to be. Last fall, when controversial Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz spoke at the University of California Berkeley Law School, someone drew a swastika over his photo. Sheriminski, by then dean of the Berkeley Law School, sent a note to every student and faculty member condemning the incident. These examples illustrate one way universities can fight hate speech without violating the First Amendment. By publicly denouncing it, Sheriminski said at a free speech forum at the University of Illinois campus Tuesday afternoon. It was one of the few areas where Sheriminski differed, but only slightly, with his fellow panelist and First Amendment advocate Jeffrey Stone, a law professor at the University of Chicago, on how campuses can respond to free speech amendments. The two constitutional scholars were featured at the event organized by Chancellor Robert Jones and moderated by College of Law Dean Vikram Amar. During the free speech movement of the 1960s, Sheriminski said, students were the ones protesting against administrators so they could speak out about events beyond campus, such as the Vietnam War. Now it's about outsiders wanting to come to campus and students and others trying to stop them from speaking, he said. Attitudes have also changed, with surveys showing today's college students are more willing to allow campuses to restrict speech than earlier generations were, he said. Remedy? More speech. Amar said many students come to campus today without a strong sense of the history of the First Amendment and its role in social movements. If censorship were allowed on campus, Stone said, we probably would have never had a civil rights movement or a women's rights movement or a gay rights movement. Courts have made clear that the government, including public universities, cannot punish offensive speech or hate speech, though the First Amendment is not absolute, Sheriminski said. It doesn't protect speech that incites others to commit violent crimes or threats, though they have to be targeted and not mere hyperbole, or harassment, though it too has to be directed at someone or pervasive enough to interfere with job or school activities. Hate speech is protected because it expresses an ideal, albeit a deeply offensive one, he said. Sheriminski, co-author of the 2017 book Free Speech on Campus, said he doesn't want to minimize the impact of hate speech on those who have been traditionally excluded from universities. He believes it's his obligation to speak out against ideas that can cause harm to students or the campus, even if they have a right to be expressed. The best remedy for speech we don't like is more speech, he said. The University of Chicago, a private school, takes a slightly different approach, dating back to the Vietnam era. Students then, including Stone, pushed the university to condemn the Vietnam War as immoral, but administrators argued that universities should not pick sides on public policy issues unless they directly affect the functioning of the school. A university, they said, should be a place where faculty and students feel free to advocate positions they believe in and the school shouldn't judge what are right and wrong, he said. Chemerinsky said campuses can also legally restrict the time, place, or manner of a speaker to prevent disruption of campus activities. Backlash in Berkeley. At Berkeley last year, Chancellor Carol Christ asked for Chemerinsky's advice in dealing with a four-day free speech week planned by conservative groups that was to feature controversial speakers such as Milo Yiannopoulos and Coulter and Steve Bannon. A talk by Yiannopoulos the previous semester had prompted a riot when outsiders posters showed up. At one meeting, a faculty member and a student argued that any speaker linked to white supremacists should be banned from campus, writing, "Resounding applause from the crowd," Chemerinsky said. I spoke up and said, "Let's be clear about what the law allows here. If she excludes the speakers, she gets sued and she would lose," he said. The excluded speakers would be turned into martyrs and get to speak anyway. No one applauded when I said that. He did advise her, however, to place provocative speakers in large auditoriums where tickets and IDs are required and metal detectors could be used around the perimeter to minimize safety risks. The free speech week was eventually canceled, but the campus spent nearly $4 million on security for three free speech events in a one-month period. Money that takes away from the school's educational mission, he said. Amar asked who should bear that cost, the campus, the speaker, or the student sponsors. Stone said it's a tough issue. Obviously, universities have limited resources and you don't want to bankrupt the institution in order to spend millions of dollars to protect speakers on campus who will trigger this kind of violence and protest. But courts haven't settled at what point schools can use that argument to stop a speech. If you allow individuals who oppose a speaker's view to threaten violence in order to shut down that speech, then you've given them a heckler's veto, something the Supreme Court has found unconstitutional, Stone said. Now news with regard to health care. The headline is, "Fine for Death of Resident, $32,500," by Deborah Pressey. Helia Healthcare of Champaign will pay a $32,500 fine in connection with the December 30, 2017 death of a resident who wandered outside on a bitterly cold night. The nursing home was originally fined $50,000, double the amount for a Class AA violation, the most serious handed down by state health officials. State law allows for a fine to be doubled if the violation falls into a high-risk category. The fine was reduced to the lower amount after Helia didn't contest the violation and fine and waived its right to a hearing, according to Illinois Department of Public Health spokeswoman Helena Arnold. The death of 69-year-old Annette White, a patient with Alzheimer's disease, occurred after she apparently wandered outside alone in thin pants, a blouse, socks, and one shoe on a night the temperature had dropped to 8 degrees below zero. Ms. White was found by staff about 11 p.m. December 30th, lying flat on her back outside a kitchen door at the nursing home at 1950 South Mattis Avenue, C. She didn't have a pulse, and her body was ice cold, according to IDHP investigators in a report following the death. The report said investigators concluded the nursing home failed to effectively monitor Ms. White, who had severe cognitive impairment and a history of wandering that left her at risk. Four other patients with a history of wandering behavior at this nursing home were also considered to have been at risk. The nurse who found Ms. White's body told investigators she had arrived at work about 10 and she was told by a nurse's aide about a half hour later that Ms. White was missing. Employees told investigators that a door from the dining room to the kitchen had typically been left open, and that three exterior doors in the kitchen hadn't been equipped with alarms, though they did have alarms as of January 3rd. Since Ms. White's death, Helia Healthcare has taken steps to correct safety issues, according to the IDHP. And now, selections from our local section. The first story regards the Ebert Film Festival, and it is headlined, "There's Still Time to Catch the Show." Tickets available for all but one show. By Frank R. Pieper. If you don't have an Eberfest pass and would still like to see The Fugitive at 7 p.m. today, you're not too late yet. As of late Tuesday afternoon, individual tickets were still available to the Roger Ebert Film Festival's opening movie, as well as to all of the other films in this year's lineup. With the exception of Saturday night's showing of The Big Lebowski, which is sold out, officials in the Virginia Theater Box Office recommend that anyone interested in individual tickets to one of the festival's 12 films call the Oxb office at 217-356-9063. The standard ticket price is $15 per show, $13 for University of Illinois students with an ID, as well as senior citizens. If a movie does sell out, the Virginia will do rush seating, in which tickets for any unoccupied seats will be sold once all ticket holders are seated before the start of each show. For these films, the Virginia recommends showing up an hour before the scheduled showtime for your best chance at scoring a seat. The box office is open from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. daily, or 2 hours before each show, and tickets can be purchased there or by phone during those hours or online anytime at thevirginia.org. Tom Kasich brings us a story headlined Friedrich's Herald Holds Solid Footing. The two candidates from Champaign County who will be on the statewide ballot this fall, with a chance of holding one-third of the executive offices in Illinois, start the general election campaign in relatively good financial shape. Urbana Republican Erica Herold, seeking to become the first GOP Attorney General since 2003, and only the second since 1983, doesn't have a lot of money in her campaign fund, but neither does her Democratic opponent, State Senator Kwame Raoul of Chicago. Raoul reported $99,010 on hand on March 31st to $91,557 for Herold. While Herold had only one opponent in the GOP primary and reported spending only about $260,000 in the January through March period, Raoul was one of the eight candidates for the Democratic nomination and spent more than $2.7 million in the quarter. The two are seeking to succeed 15-year Democratic Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who chose not to run for a fifth term. Champaign Democrat Mike Friedrichs, hoping to become the first Democrat elected to consecutive terms as state treasurer since the late Alan Dixon in 1974, has a healthy fundraising lead on his Republican challenger, Orland Park Village Trustee Jim Dodge. Friedrichs reported $719,349 in his campaign fund March 31 to $15,353 for Dodge, and outraised his Republican opponent during the first quarter, $271,108 to $35,207. Barring some unforeseen development, Friedrichs has clear path to re-election with advantages in name recognition and fundraising, along with Illinois' recent Democratic tendency. "Obviously, I think Friedrichs is going to win," said University of Illinois Springfield Emeritus Professor Kent Redfield, "and the real question is the Attorney General's race." Harold's chance for success this fall is less clear. While she has Governor Bruce Rauner's financial support, his campaign paid for $305,000 in media for Harold in the first quarter, she's also linked to him politically, for better or worse. He recruited her to run, has endorsed her, and has campaigned with her. And the Illinois Republican Party is still divided after a tough gubernatorial primary between Rauner and Jeannie Ives. Until the GOP is united and solid behind Rauner, the rest of the ticket is at risk of defeat by apathy. But Redfield said that Harold has a decent chance to win. "She's already talked about how we're going to make the office about fighting corruption. She can do that in ways against Raul," he said. "She may be better to use Raul's narrative that we need to have a watchdog to fight corruption than he will. He's certainly a damaged messenger on that point, but she can benefit from the way that he has framed things. There are a lot of uncertainties, though. Everything can get caught up in a blue wave, or she can be a terribly underfunded candidate if Rauner's campaign is crashing and he's not putting any money into it at the end. All things being equal, you give the Democrats in a statewide race the advantage on paper, but I think that's one that really is winnable. And Raul has some vulnerabilities in terms of who he has taken money from, tobacco companies, utility companies, and a lobbyist who has been accused of inappropriate behavior, and those kinds of issues. I would be surprised if it's not competitive, and I would not be surprised if she won. If he had to be the House, Redfield said, I'd probably put it on Raul. But she runs a smart campaign, and he doesn't, that's going to be even more in her favor. That would boost Champaign County's chance of having two statewide office holders simultaneously for the first time in Illinois' 200 years of existence. They have been only a handful of statewide office holders from the county anyway. Friedrichs as treasurer, and three men who held offices that were abolished under the 1970 Constitution. Vernon Nickel, who was superintendent of public construction in the 40s and 50s, and Jamie McCullough and Lloyd Morey, both of whom served as auditor of public accounts. Illinois has never had an attorney general from Champaign County, and hasn't had one from downstate Illinois since Democrat Ivan Elliott in 1948. Elliott was from White County in southern Illinois. County clerk spending. Matt Grandon, who won the Republican primary for Champaign County clerk last month by 670 votes, spent almost $50,000 in doing so. John Rector, who spent about a quarter of that amount, $13,803, came close with more than 47% of the vote. Now, Grandon has to do it all over again with only about $760 in his campaign fund. His next opponent, Democrat Aaron Ammons, was unopposed in the primary election and had reported $14,833 in his campaign fund on March 31st. Most of Grandon's money came from his family, $35,000 from his parents and $3,300 from himself. Most of Ammons' money came from labor unions, including $5,000 from Service Employees International, Union Local 73 in Chicago, and $2,500 from the SEIU Healthcare PAC. County Executive Money. Gordy Hulton, who has been Champaign County Clerk for 8 years and has the name identification that comes with the office, also has the early money advantage in the history-making race coming this fall. Hulton and Urbana Democrat Darlene Klopel are the candidates for Champaign County Executive, a new $117,000-a-year salary position approved by voters in November 2016. While Klopel received $2,000 in campaign contributions in the first quarter of 2018, Hulton collected more than $9,000. He has $23,055 on March 31st, while Klopel has $562. Hulton's biggest contributions was $5,000 from the Champaign County Farm Bureau, with whom he worked 2 years ago to promote the creation of the county executive position. Klopel, who can be seen at just about any community or civic event or meeting, is going to have to rely on handshaking and shoe leather. Jim Dye has a story today. The headline is, Towns Under Heavy Police Fire Pensions Pressure. As the Democratic and Republican gubernatorial candidates crisscross Illinois in search of votes, each has his own points of campaign emphasis. Republican incumbent Bruce Rauner never misses a chance to bash Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan as the source of many of the state's woes. He contends that only bold economic reforms can lift the state from fiscal despair. Democrat J.B. Pritzker, a billionaire Chicago businessman, just as reflexively denounces Rauner as a failed governor. Pritzker also touts his plan for income tax increases he intends to use to finance a series of social welfare programs. But to hear some critics tell it, there's one issue neither wants to address, the $130 billion public pension shortfall elephant standing in the corner of the room. It's a ticking time bomb few want to discuss, let alone take steps to resolve. Rivals Bruce Rauner and J.B. Pritzker so far have found common purposes in tiptoeing around the pension minefield that will likely dictate the success or failure of whichever of them is sworn in next year, writes Tom Jones of Chicago's Better Government Association. Jones reports that chronic political instinct to put off tough decisions until after the next election has ballooned the cost and narrowed pension fixing options to either excessively painful or pie in the sky. But Illinois public pension problem is not just a singular phrase. It's a plural problem. That's because Illinois municipalities also have a pension problem starting to bubble to the surface. Anyone ever heard of Harvey? It's an impoverished community in the Chicago area that has been borrowing from Peter to pay Paul for years at the expense of its police and fire pension systems. Illinois Comptroller Susan Mendoza, relying on state law, recently started garnishing Harvey's tax revenues to make up for what Harvey officials have not been paying into the city's police and fire pensions. Harvey is challenging the state's right to garnish its revenues, and the issue is tangled up in the courts. But the Illinois political Institute reports the municipality pension mess is everywhere, and that Harvey could be just the start of a flood of garnishments across the state. IPI's Ted Dabrowski and John Klinger report that municipal pension woes run from East St. Louis to Rockford and from Quincy to Danville. The fallout from Comptroller Mendoza's garnishment order in Harvey was dramatic. After losing $1.5 million since February, Harvey's officials laid off 31 employees, 13 police officers, and 18 firefighters, half of its department. Citing public records, the IPI, a free market-based think tank loaded in Springfield and Chicago, indicates that more than 400 police and fire public pension funds, or 63% of Illinois' total downstate public safety funds, received less funding than what was required from their cities in 2016, the most recent year for which state data is available. Theoretically, at least, that status makes those communities vulnerable to garnishment orders by the Comptroller's office. It's not just low-income or impoverished communities East St. Louis, Centralia, that are behind the pension eight ball right now. Many Illinois communities have fire and police funding levels in the 20% and 30% range. The Champaign contributed $3.3 million to its fire fund, $947 extra. The city's 5% fund is 79% funded. Urbana contributed $1.3 million to its fire pension, $220,000 short of the required contribution. The fund is 80% funded. Rantoul contributed $683,000 to its police pension, $136,000 short of what was required. Rantoul's public police pension is 66% funded. IPI reports that even as municipal pension contributions have been funded since 2005, pension debt also can double. It attributed the problem to ballooning pension promises that have seen total pension benefits allowed to public safety workers and retirees go from $2.6 billion in 1987 to $23.4 billion today, nearly an 800% increase. Well, thank you, radio readers, for listening in. Our reading for today's News Gazette will continue in a moment.